Lieutenant Governor John Walsh releases his military records to the public in response to reports of a reprimand a few years ago. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about a new medical helicopter base in Butte, and in tonight's feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with the new CEO of the Montana Community Foundation. But first, we have this breaking news. A House plan to make major cuts to food stamps would be scaled back under a bipartisan agreement on a massive farm bill, a near end to more than a two-year fight that has threatened to hurt rural lawmakers in an election year. The measure announced by the House and Senate Agriculture Committees preserves food stamps benefits for most Americans who receive them and continues generous subsidies for farmers. The House could vote on the bill as soon as Wednesday. The compromise was expected to cut food stamps by about $800 million a year, or around 1%. The House in September passed legislation cutting 5% from the $80 billion a year program. The Democratic-controlled Senate had passed a bill worth $400 million in annual food stamp cuts. In other news from around the state, Lieutenant Governor and Democratic Senate candidate John Walsh has released 400 pages of his military records to the public, hoping to disprove questions about his leadership. Media outlets have recently obtained documents showing Walsh received a reprimand from the Army in 2010. The reprimand says Walsh used his position as the state's adjutant general to solicit Montana National Guard troops to join a private organization for which he was seeking a leadership role. The release of military records comes just ahead of confirmation hearings for Senator Max Baucus, who has been nominated as the next ambassador to China. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us Walsh would like to be appointed to fill the remainder of Baucus' term.
This man's integrity, courage, and his honesty are above reproach. And
a Sunday press conference at the Senate campaign headquarters of Lieutenant Governor John Walsh has fellow military officers standing behind Walsh as a candidate and as a leader.
It's not a problem because he always had our best interests at heart.
The 2010 reprimand from the Army is not considered military punishment. It says Walsh used his official capacity to pressure subordinates to join an organization called the National Guard Association of the United States. It's a group that lobbies for the Guard and provides educational outreach programs to the public. Walsh was running to be vice chair of the organization at the time and wrote low membership by Montanans in the group may have put his chances of getting that position at risk. The Defense Department's ethics rules prohibit this kind of request Walsh was making of subordinates. Army Vice Chief of Staff Peter Corelli wrote in his reprimand, quote, "Your failure to adhere to the Army values causes me to question your ability to lead."
I will never apologize for fighting for the men and women of the Montana National Guard.
Lieutenant Governor Walsh says he was running for the unpaid vice chairmanship to help better the state's position within the Guard.
I would have a seat at the table to be making decisions that were going to impact not only the National Guard as a whole, but more importantly, the Montana National Guard.
Walsh says by releasing all of his military records, Montanans can decide for themselves if he's been an effective leader. He's running for the Senate seat, which was supposed to be vacated by Senator Max Baucus at the end of this year. But then came the surprise announcement Baucus could be leaving his seat very soon if he is confirmed as the ambassador to China. Appointing someone to fill that spot for the rest of the year would be up to Governor Steve Bullock. Lieutenant Governor Walsh has formally expressed his interest.
If Senator Baucus is confirmed and he and Governor Bullock is considering candidates to fill that position, I would like to fill that position, yes.
It's widely expected Bullock will choose Walsh. Being in the position for much of the year could help Walsh secure the seat in the November election against likely Republican candidate Congressman Steve Daines. Montana Republicans say a Walsh appointment would amount to a backroom political deal. Republican State Senate President Jeff Essman says Montana citizens should feel they had a say in that process.
I think the governor deserves to give the people of Montana an explanation of how he's going to conduct his process of making the appointment.
Governor Bullock says he does not want to comment on what he characterizes as the hypothetical situation of Senator Baucus's appointment, and has not set a timeline for choosing a replacement.
First, we have to see if this happens, when it happens, but no, I expect to move quickly.
Senator Baucus's confirmation hearing before the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee is scheduled for this Tuesday. Montana Public Radio will have full coverage of that hearing. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Nearly every day for 6 years, Zach Taylor ate at the Three Forks Cafe. Waitresses tell the Bozeman Daily Chronicle he even had his own bottle of hazelnut syrup for his coffee with the name Zach on it. But what people didn't know was that Zach Taylor, the computer repairman who lived north of Three Forks, was actually 55-year-old Daniel Chafee, a fugitive who failed to show up for his September 1998 trial on charges of rape, sexual abuse, and sodomy in Roseburg, Oregon. The FBI alleges Chafee recruited girls to form what he called the Cobalt Clan. Authorities say his goal was to have a large number of children over whom he could rule. Chafee was arrested near Bozeman on January 15th and awaits extradition back to Oregon.
Police in Missoula say they're looking for a man who robbed a coffee stand yesterday morning using a 6-inch hunting knife. The Missoula Police Department tells the Missoulian that no one was injured and that the man made off with an undisclosed amount of cash from the Florence Coffee Company stand on Southwest Higgins Avenue. Missoula Police Corporal Sean Monroska says the suspect is a 6'2" white male with an average build and in his mid to late 50s. He wore a bandana over his face. Monroska says the man wore a dark blue hooded sweatshirt, dark jeans, and tan work boots to the 11 a.m. robbery. Police are continuing to investigate.
Idaho could soon join a handful of states that allow students, teachers, and others to bring guns to class. A proposal in the Senate State Affairs Committee would allow retired law enforcement officers and people with Idaho's enhanced concealed carry permit to bring firearms to campus, even if the college bans guns on its property. Enhanced concealed carry permits require completion of an 8-hour training class with a certified instructor. Guns will be prohibited from dormitories or residence halls and facilities seating more than 1,000 people, like stadiums or concert halls. Anyone under the influence of drugs or alcohol would also be barred from carrying firearms. The motion, which comes after two fatal shootings on college campuses last week, will now travel through the House and Senate for approval.
Trial is scheduled to start on May 28th for a 25-year-old Bozeman man charged with killing one man and injuring another during a shooting outside a house party. Cody Christopher Little is charged with deliberate homicide for the September 20th shooting that fatally injured Larry L.J. Clayton. He died the next day at a Seattle hospital. Little also faces two counts of attempted deliberate homicide. Prosecutors allege Little fired a shot that hit James Armstrong in the leg and later pointed a shotgun at Riley Ray's face and pulled the trigger, but the gun didn't fire. Little has said the shooting was in self-defense. He has been jailed on a $1.25 million bail since his arrest. The trial before District Judge Holly Brown is scheduled to take 8 days.
A 28-year-old Missoula man has died after a horse trailer disconnected from a pickup and crossed the center line where it collided with the passenger vehicle. The Montana Highway Patrol says the crash in Glacier County occurred about 11 a.m. Saturday on U.S. Highway 2 near Browning. Police say the trailer struck a 2006 Chrysler 300 on the passenger side, killing the man sitting there. He was pronounced dead at the scene. Police say the driver of the pickup is a 59-year-old man from Browning who was also injured.
Life Flight Network announced the opening of a new helicopter base in Butte today. The base at Burt Mooney Airport is home to a new medical helicopter and 14 employees. Life Flight Network's Region 3 Director Dominic Pomponio says new helicopter will supplement emergency response in most of the southwest portion of the state.
So, I mean, basically what we look at is, how accessible to tertiary level care is it for an area? How long does it take you to get a helicopter or a fixed wing to very remote areas of the state or geography? And so basing a helicopter in Butte gives us very ready access to the patrons in Dillon, Anaconda, Helena, Butte, I mean, pretty much all over the southwest region. You have a very vast geographic area here. So, a patient who is suffering a heart attack in a very small community may have a very long distance to get to that tertiary level care. So that's really where we hope that we can come in and partner with these facilities as well as EMS agencies to get the patients to the tertiary centers as quickly as we can.
Pomponio says new Augusta Westland Koala Air medical helicopter is the perfect aircraft when critical care transport is needed and time is of the essence.
It is a very, very fast helicopter. I can tell you we took a trip this morning down to Dillon to do a little orientation flight, look at the helipads in some regional areas, and we were reaching speeds of 150 knots with it very, very readily. So it's a very, very fast helicopter. In addition to that, as a clinician, I like the aspect that I have full access to the entire patient in the back of the helicopter. There's really nothing I can't do in the helicopter because of the way the cabin is configured.
LifeFlight Network is the nation's largest non-for-profit air medical transport service.
A plan to renovate the Wilson Auditorium in Bozeman has received a $300,000 donation. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports the donation from the Gilhausen Foundation raises the total donations received so far to $2.5 million. The Bozeman Schools Foundation hopes to raise $3.5 million by the end of March for work needed to fix up Bozeman's largest performance space. Schools Foundation Director Mary Jo O'Donnell says the money raised so far is enough to fix up the auditorium itself. That involves reupholstering 1,100 seats and improving acoustics for $1.8 million. She says the next priority is installing an elevator and bathrooms at a cost of $700,000.
Whitefish skier Maggie Voisin, who is the youngest Olympian representing the United States in the Winter Olympics, is now the youngest athlete to ever compete in and medal at the Winter X Games, according to ESPN. The 15-year-old Voisin had a top score of 90 and won a silver medal in the women's ski slopestyle yesterday afternoon in Aspen, Colorado. Kaya Tursky of Canada won gold with a score of 91.33. Darian Stevens of Missoula finished seventh in a field of eight competitors. The 17-year-old's top score over her three runs was 76.33.
Montana's largest community foundation has hired a new chief executive officer who brings almost 20 years of philanthropic experience with her. Mary Rutherford takes the helm of the Montana Community Foundation, which is comprised of more than 560 philanthropic funds with over $72 million in assets. The foundation features affiliate community foundations in 45 Montana communities and, using Rutherford's words, quote, exists to serve Montana forever, end quote. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Rutherford explains her organization receives gifts, such as endowed funds, to benefit charitable causes important to donors.
So we have about over $70 million, maybe up to $74 million under management. Some of those funds are permanently endowed, so we use a portion of the investment earnings to award to communities in Montana or causes in Montana that the donors cared enough about to establish funds with us.
What sort of organizations, what kind of causes?
Well, the Women's Foundation of Montana is actually a fund of the Montana Community Foundation, so that's probably a fairly well-known purpose. We have the Big Sky Honor Flight, which I'm guessing your listeners know about, which is the annual trips that occur a few times a year where we take war veterans back to Washington, D.C. to see the war memorials to honor the times when they served. Mm-hmm. So that Big Sky Honor Flight is a fund here at the Montana Community Foundation that people and organizations contribute to, and then we use those funds for that purpose. Also, we have some community type funds here. So we have, for example, the Great Falls Beautification Committee. And so people contribute to that fund. We invest those funds and then on an annual basis distribute funds to them, and they use it for the beautification of their community. So those are just three examples of the types of funds we have.
Sounds like a varied portfolio.
It is. And it's, you know, it's as varied as the interests of the people who establish the funds. And we serve and we reach the entire state. So it's not just Helena, where we're located, or Missoula or Billings. It's areas all across Montana.
I read that you have an MA in philanthropic studies from Indiana University. What is it about philanthropy that seems to intrigue you so much?
I was shocked to learn when I started in this career field that it's sort of one of the few things that make America so different than any other country on the planet. And that is that we as a people rise up and serve people beyond ourselves and causes beyond ourselves that matter to us and mean something to us. And so when Alexis de Tocqueville came to the United States and spent some time here hundreds of years ago and observed what was happening in America, the thing that was unique about America continues to be unique about America today, and that is our philanthropic passion and our commitment to serving others. That's not to say that other countries don't do that, but it is something that was identified early on as unique to America. So when I learned about de Tocqueville and started studying the field and actually started working in special events fundraising, I thought, wow, there's a lot more to this. And there's a lot more to this beyond the historical aspect, but the legal aspect, the governance aspect, the fiduciary responsibilities that we all have in the nonprofit sector. So I sought out programs across the country and frankly thought that Indiana University's program was leading edge and the best in the country. And after having a business undergraduate degree, pursued and earned my master's degree in philanthropic studies there.
You also served as president of the University of Alaska Foundation and chief development officer for the University of Alaska. And you're a native of Idaho, right?
Yes. I'm actually a fifth-generation Idahoan. My family homesteaded there, and my great-aunt still owns the family homestead and spent a lot of time in north-central Idaho and western Montana as a kid growing up, fly fishing and camping and what have you. Our family moved to Alaska. I lived there two different times and most recently served as the chief development officer and the president of the University of Alaska Foundation. So it was a big job, big organization, big state, obviously, but really similar to Montana in that large footprint, large geographic land mass, relatively small population, and a little bit of a shift in terms of the rest of the country as it relates to charitable giving. So it was a great opportunity, great challenge. I just did not love cold and sub-zero temperatures from October through April. So I had to go.
You mentioned a shift in, what was it, you said charitable giving or?
Yeah, so across America, philanthropic gifts, charitable gifts are largely given by individuals. I think it's something like 86% of the charitable gifts that are made in America are made by individuals. In Alaska, exactly the opposite was true, in that the large portion of charitable gifts that were made by corporations and foundations. And so it became a matter of focusing on growing individual philanthropy and talking about how we all can be philanthropists in our lives. And sure, we may not all have the ability to write a $1 million check, but coming together, we can do remarkable things as a group. And so when I started looking at Montana and Montana Community Foundation and reading about the philanthropic divide, I thought, aha, there are a lot of similarities between Alaska and Montana that were appealing to me. Something else that I just want to mention that I think is remarkable about Montana that I just kind of figured out last week when I was looking through a bunch of historical documents is something that makes Montana unique is that we have governors here who pay attention to philanthropy and talk about philanthropy and have panels on philanthropy and task forces and groups, whereas when I've looked at my work and just looked at Idaho, Washington, and Alaska, all of those states I've lived in, none of those have governors that talk about philanthropy. It's just so exciting to come here where philanthropy and the impact you can have on the future is talked about all across broad spectrums of the population, from the governor to the lady who makes your coffee in the mornings. It's great. I love it.
And yet, there's really not, generally speaking, a heck of a lot of money in Montana. This is not a very wealthy state, and that has to be concerning, I guess.
Well, it's not concerning to me because, you know, it's kind of that Old West spirit of coming together and helping people out and leaving something behind better than you found it. And that's what I've been on the job 3 weeks, so clearly I have a lot to learn. But in the 3 weeks I've been here, it's been fabulous visiting with people who have established funds here or considering establishing funds here, you know, who may have pieces of farm ground that, gosh, you know, my kids aren't farming it anymore or they're not likely to farm it after I'm long gone. What can I do to preserve the things in Montana that mean something to me? And while people might not have a lot of cash wealth, they're certainly generous. And I think it's surprising to think about what has been left behind, what is being left behind, and then also exploring those organizations that care about Montana that maybe aren't located here, but partnering with them to make Montana even greater.
What does the foundation know about the transfer of wealth from one generation of Montanans to the next?
Well, I believe the Montana Community Foundation actually sponsored that study, the Great Transfer of Wealth, the Philanthropic Divide. And we know that there's going to be a very significant transfer of wealth coming forward in this generation, next generations. And this is absolutely the time for Montana to step up, take stock, and say, how can we make sure that that transfer of wealth doesn't in total leave Montana, stays here in part to preserve and perpetuate those things we care about?
Do you think younger generations are keyed into charitable givings like their parents and their grandparents, or are things changing on that front?
I think the same heart and the same spirit exists. It's a different society, no doubt. You know, there's this whole philosophy of bowling alone, how, you know, there used to be in the 50s great bowling leagues where people created social capital and did things together, and they were a society that was blended together and worked together. And now you look at today's generation, and their ways of connecting isn't the same way that the generations of the 50s connected. They're still connecting, it's just a different way. And I think that's happening in philanthropy as well. I think it's eye-opening to look at how the methods of receiving and raising funds has shifted. You know, organizations are raising large, large, large sums of money through Kickstarter campaigns, online, social networking. So they're still giving, and they're raising a lot of money in a very short period of time. They're just not using the traditional methods.
Last question. Does the Bakken boom represent a potential philanthropic resource, or is that just a different thing altogether?
No, absolutely it does, without question. The discoveries in the Bakken and the people who own the properties where those discoveries are being made and the companies that are making those discoveries have great opportunities to, again, preserve and perpetuate the things in Montana they care about through the creation of wealth that the Bakken has brought. I'm not, you know, being in Alaska, transient kind of population in terms of the oil boom and bust cycle, et cetera, I'm not sure that you're going to have the folks who are going to be the oil field workers are going to be your philanthropists. But I really think that those people who own the land, those companies that are making great profits in the Bakken, definitely have the opportunity to be philanthropists in Montana.
I've been speaking with Mary Rutherford, the new chief executive officer of the Montana Community Foundation. Excellent talking, and welcome to Montana.
Thanks. Thanks so much. Take care.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with lows 5 to 12 degrees. Tomorrow expect partly cloudy skies with highs in the 30s. With central Montana tonight, it should be mostly clear and lows 0 to 10 above. Tomorrow expect partly cloudy skies, highs 30 to 40 degrees with wind gusts up to 35 miles per hour in the afternoon. In southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly clear skies with lows 0 to 10 above. And tomorrow should be sunny with highs 25 to 35 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
The last substantial project that Senator Max Baucus was working on when he was tapped by the White House to become the new U.S. ambassador to China was the overhaul of the American federal tax code. As chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Baucus was well positioned to push through a simplification of the tax code that might get bipartisan support. Republicans want to simplify the tax code because it's so complex and arcane that it encourages incredible waste in the form of money being spent interpreting it and dodging tax payments. In addition, the current code has incorporated so many loopholes that the pattern of taxes has arbitrary and unfair impacts on different types of economic activity. Democrats are interested in a federal tax overhaul for those reasons and another important one. By cleaning up the tax code and simplifying it, it is possible to generate more federal tax revenues while possibly lowering the marginal tax rates that now apply to income and profits. That could allow enhanced federal revenues to support federal programs without adding to the deficit and without discouraging economic activity. One of the areas on which the Baucus federal tax overhaul has focused has been the special tax loopholes offered to the oil and gas industry. These loopholes sometimes allow large oil companies to avoid income taxes altogether, even when they are earning spectacular profits. Many of those loopholes were put in place almost a century ago to encourage more oil drilling. Others came as the result of the oil and gas companies insisting that they get treated the same as infant industries struggling to get a foothold in the economy, or as declining American industries that are being lured overseas and need help to stay in the United States. Of course, the American oil and gas industry is neither of these. It is a very profitable, well-established industry that in some ways dominates the American economy. It does not need special assistance from U.S. taxpayers, while those citizens have to continue to pay what appears to be permanently high prices at the gas pump. The oil and gas industry, of course, is fighting back. Some of that effort is being focused on Montana, Baucus's home state, that also happens to be an energy-producing state. The argument being used by oil and gas interests in Montana is that energy development in Montana, especially oil development in the Bakken fields in northeastern Montana, is central to the economic development of the state. As one op-ed piece recently published in Montana newspapers put it, quote, "There is no doubt that tax policies singling out the energy industry would have a disproportionate impact on Montana, where energy is such a large part of our export economy," unquote. Energy production, including oil, natural gas, coal, hydroelectric, and wind electric generation, is an important part of the Montana economy. But energy production is also very capital intensive rather than labor intensive. As a result, except during temporary boom periods such as is being experienced in the Bakken, the employment associated with energy production is relatively modest. Between 2001 and 2011, job growth in Montana totaled about 69,000 jobs. That is, on average, there was a gain of about 6,900 jobs each year. All mining activities, including oil, gas, coal, metals, sand, and gravel, were the direct source of about 8% of those new jobs, adding about 540 jobs a year. In Richland County, home of Sydney and the center of the Montana Bakken boom, the oil industry directly added about 60 jobs each year. Clearly, the expansion of these mineral extraction jobs does not directly explain most of the job gains in Montana. Where were the bulk of the jobs being created in the Montana economy over the last decade? Over 86% of the jobs created were in service industries. About 9% were in government and 3% in retail and wholesale trade. That accounts for almost all of the jobs created over the last 10 years in Montana, 98% of them. If we look at the goods-producing industries of agriculture, mining, and manufacturing combined, there was actually a shrinkage of 1,700 jobs over the last decade, as job losses in agriculture and manufacturing offset the job gains in mining. This description of where job creation has been taking place in the Montana economy does not take into account the ripple or multiplier effects of the mining jobs and the high pay associated with them. Nor does it consider the revenues that flow into government coffers due to mineral production taxes, royalties, and rents. Both of these can be significant. Mining jobs in Montana in 2012 paid $98,000 per year, and the Montana state government took in $431 million in revenues from mineral production that year. Clearly, energy production in Montana is important to workers and governments receiving that income and the communities in which they live. However, Montana's economy is not an energy economy or a mining economy. The Treasure State logo and the reference to mining on the Montana state flag is a reference to the 19th and early 20th century history of Montana. As the employment data make clear, the Montana economy now is a very diversified one, not an economy driven by a single extractive industry, whose political bidding we have to do in order to maintain a vital and prosperous economy.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.